11:30. The heat had already settled over the village like a wool blanket, thick and suffocating, and Concetta stood in the narrow shade of the church portico with her hand resting on the iron ring of the door. It was cold and pitted with age, a small mercy against the sun. Behind her, the bells had finished their morning calling three sets, one for the high altar, one for the nave, one for the bell tower, and their echoes still lingered in the narrow street like smoke that refused to dissipate. She did not knock. She waited. She had learned patience from Andrea, or perhaps she had only learned it from the silence he left behind. A shadow moved behind the door. The lock turned with a mechanical click, heavy and deliberate. The door opened inward, and Padre Salvador stood in the threshold, his face pale beneath the white collar that seemed to float against his throat like a floating piece of paper. He was a small man, not tall, not broad, but he carried himself with the soft authority of someone who had spoken to thousands of people and expected them to listen. His eyes were blue, the color of shallow water, and they took in Concetta with a mixture of welcome and calculation. "Padre Salvador," he said. His voice was soft, melodic, the kind of voice that could make a penitentiary confession sound like a blessing. "You come to Mass." "No, Padre," she said. Her voice came out quieter than she intended. She focused on the stone step beneath her feet, cracked and uneven, the way it had been since before she was born. It was easier than looking into his eyes, which were too bright, too knowing, too full of a charity that felt like pity. "I come about the manifest." He did not move. He did not step aside to invite her in. He simply stood in the doorway, blocking the passage between the street and the cool, incense-heavy interior of the church, and regarded her with a calm that was almost paternal. Almost. "The manifest," he repeated. The words tasted strange in his mouth, as though he were pronouncing something foreign, something that did not belong in the sacred space of the church door. "You speak of ships now, since your visit to the harbor master." She felt the priest's gaze settle on her, heavy and appraising. It was not defiance that made her straighten. It was the instinct of someone standing too close to a cliff edge. "He told me about Il Gabbiano." "He told you what he wanted you to hear. And you want me to believe that what he didn't tell me is the whole truth." Padre Salvador's mouth tightened, barely, the way a river tightens before it hits a rock. He glanced past her, down the narrow street, checking for witnesses. The village was awake, women with baskets on their hips, men with tools slung over their shoulders, children running between the houses with their shirts sticking to their backs in the heat, but no one was close enough to overhear. This was the kind of conversation the church preferred: intimate, private, contained. "Concetta," he said, and he used her first name for the first time, which made her skin prickle with something that was not entirely unpleasant. "Come inside. We can speak where the air is cooler." She did not move. "I don't have much time. Enzo expects me home by noon." It was a lie. Enzo did not expect anything from her by noon. He was out on La Barca, hauling nets that caught nothing but seaweed and the occasional tin can, and he would not return until the afternoon was well advanced and the light had begun to lean gold against the rooftops. But she needed the excuse. She needed the pretense that her life was still structured, still predictable, still governed by the small rituals of a widow's routine. Padre Salvador studied her for a moment. He was good at studying people. It was part of his vocation, or perhaps it was something older than vocation, something that had made him a priest before he had ever touched a Bible. He had a way of looking at people that made them feel both seen and judged, simultaneously. "You think I am protecting a lie," he said quietly. "I think you are protecting a story," she corrected. Her voice was steady. She was surprised by its steadiness. "There is a difference." He closed his eyes briefly, as though praying for patience. When he opened them, they were softer, almost sad. "And what story would you have me tell? That three ships left this harbor in October 1943? That one of them carried medical supplies marked for a hospital that no longer exists? That a young man named Andrea Marino was on board?" She did not answer. The air between them was thick with the things neither of them would say aloud. The church behind him smelled of beeswax and old stone, of incense that had soaked into the walls over decades and decades of masses said for the dead. She could feel the warmth of it pressing against her back, a physical weight, like a hand on her shoulder. "Padre," she began, then stopped. She had rehearsed this conversation in her head 100 times, in the quiet hours before dawn when the house was cold, and Enzo slept beside her with the steady breathing of a man who had never doubted anything in his life. But now that she stood before him, the words felt inadequate, clumsy, like stones thrown at a window that was too thick to break. "What do you want from me, Concetta?" he asked. His voice was gentle, almost kind. "Do you want an apology? Do you want a confession? Or do you simply want someone to admit that the story we told, the story of Andrea Marino, who died heroically in a hospital bed in Bologna, surrounded by nurses and priests and the comfort of his country, was a convenient fiction?" She flinched, not visibly, no one watching would have noticed. But inside, something shifted, a small fracture spreading through the careful architecture of her composure. He was right. He was exactly, devastatingly right. The story had been convenient. It had been necessary. After Andrea's death or his disappearance or whatever it had been, the village needed a narrative. They needed a son who had died bravely, a husband who had died well, a young man whose body might never be found but whose name could be carved into marble and polished by grieving fingers. The truth, whatever it was, did not fit into that narrative. The truth was messy and inconvenient and impossible to bury beneath a headstone. "It doesn't matter what I want," she said. Her voice was barely above a whisper. "It matters what happened." Padre Salvatore leaned forward, just slightly, until he was close enough that she could smell the faint scent of lavender soap on his skin. The same soap he used every Sunday before Mass he was trying to intimidate her, she realized. Not with volume or force, but with proximity, with the soft, melodic certainty of a man who believed he was speaking on behalf of God. "Digging up the past is not an act of piety, Concetta," he said. "It is an act of vanity. You think that if you unearth the truth, you will find something that makes sense, something that heals, but the truth does not heal. The truth only complicates, and some things are better left buried." She looked up at him then, really looked at him. His face was lined, not with age, but with the weight of years spent absorbing other people's sorrows, other people's lies, other people's desperate need for certainty. He was not a villain. He was not even an antagonist, not in the way that word was usually understood. He was a man who believed with every fiber of his being that he was doing the right thing. He believed that the village's narrative of heroic sacrifice was more important than the messy, uncomfortable truth of what had really happened to Andrea Marino on the evening of the 7th of October, 1943. And perhaps he was right. Perhaps the village needed its story more than it needed the truth. But Concetta did not need the village's story. She needed her own. She stepped back from the door. The movement was small, almost imperceptible, but it carried the weight of a decision. "I will not stop," she said. "Not because I am brave, not because I am righteous, but because I cannot unknow what I have already found. The letter was real. The date was real. Marseille was real. And if you will not tell me the truth, Padre, then I will find it myself." He did not try to stop her. He did not raise his voice or lay a hand on her arm or invoke the authority of the church to silence her. He simply stood in the doorway, his blue eyes watching her with a mixture of sorrow and something that might have been respect, and let her walk away. The street was hotter than before. The sun had climbed higher, pressing down on the rooftops with a weight that made the air shimmer. Concetta walked slowly, her feet finding the familiar rhythm of the narrow cobblestones, the ones worn smooth by generations of women who had walked this same path to Mass, to market, to grief. She did not look back. She did not need to. She could feel Padre Salvatore's gaze on her back like a physical pressure, like a hand that wanted to push but did not dare. By the time she reached the bottom of the hill, her hands were clenched into fists so tight that her nails had left crescent-shaped marks in her palms. She uncurled them slowly, deliberately, and let her arms hang at her sides. The marks would fade. They always did. But the certainty she carried now, the cold, hard certainty that she was walking toward something she could not yet name, would not fade. It would only deepen, like salt in a wound, like water in stone, like the slow, inexorable erosion of a cliff face by the sea. She thought of Andrea. She thought of Marseille. She thought of the date, which was impossible, which was impossible, which was impossible. Then she went home, unlocked the door, and went inside.